Thanks, Cheryl. And welcome, everybody. Nice to be here again. Always a pleasure to share, explore, and hang out in the truth. So as always, I will open the floor for any questions. I don't have any questions that came in by email this week. So if anyone out there has a burning question they want to ask, they can raise their hand or type it on the chat room board. And so I'll let a minute go by, and I actually have something else I can speak about, so I'll launch into that in a minute here if there's no questions that are coming up right at the moment. And as always, you can also email me during the week at nirmala@endless-satsang.com. If you have something that comes to mind and you'd like to have it addressed in these satsangs. But I'm not seeing any questions, so I will pick up. Actually, what I'm going to do is pick up where I left off in the discussion about self-inquiry. Cheryl, this would be Introduction to Self-Inquiry, Part 3. That's the title for later. And so where we were last time was just talking about some kind of practical aspects of the self-inquiry process. And actually what I'm going to speak about now is probably one of the most powerful. It's almost underselling it to call it a practical pointer or a practical aspect, because it can take the process of self-inquiry so much deeper. And it's great. I see someone on here today has the screen name Wholehearted. And so here's reading from the article. Another way to ask the self-inquiry questions is with your whole heart. You ask them with everything you've got, as if your life depended on it. If you ask a self-inquiry question with this kind of passion and intensity, it will bring you beyond what the mind is able to figure out. When you ask it with your whole heart and you don't find an answer, you just stay there, not knowing. You just let yourself not know. You know, this wholeheartedness, the purpose of self-inquiry isn't really to bring you to an idea or a concept of yourself. In fact, ultimately, it takes you beyond your concept of yourself. It takes you beyond the I thought. It first puts you in touch with the I thought, but then it ultimately is meant to dissolve, weaken, soften, loosen that sense of identity, that sense of identification, especially the I am the body thought, which is so deeply embedded, it's almost an unconscious thought. An interesting idea to have an unconscious thought. It's a thought that's so deeply assumed in all of our other thoughts that we rarely question it. It's something like the air in the room that we take for granted. Don't really pay much attention to it or question its nature or think about it really at all most of the time. We just breathe it in and out. And so this invitation to do self-inquiry with wholeheartedness, with passion, with intensity, you could say with your body, with your whole body, with your whole being, the reason for that suggestion is that by doing that, it can bring you to that place, that experience of the I thought in a more visceral sense. It can bring you to that experience of I am the body, that pure, raw sense that I exist and I am this body. And if you keep your attention on that, it's kind of like really staring someone in the eye that you know is lying to you, and eventually they can't keep it up and they break down. They say, okay, yeah, and they admit that whatever is really the truth. And so if you give this wholehearted intensity to the inquiry, who am I, what am I? And you, even when it comes to that very basic sense of I, that almost feels like that is necessary for survival, or that is your survival, that is who you are. When you have that deep unconscious belief, conviction that you are the body, I am the body, to actually shine attention on it, to wholeheartedly sense into that simple assumption, I am the body, to check, is it true? Is it real? Is that really so? And that attention can loosen the belief. It can loosen, it can start to give you a sense of a different degree of truth, a different level of truth, that possibly you are much more than the body, and that deeply held assumption is not completely true. And so it's such a challenging thing to actually start to see beyond the sense of I that's associated with the body, that's where this wholeheartedness, this whole body approach is so helpful, because it can actually feel like you're dying when that fundamental sense of who you are starts to dissolve. The sense of I, the sense of me that you've had for possibly much
says,
or most of your
life.
Life
is this simple.
When
we're living in a world
that starts to dissolve, when you start to not, as I say here, you stay there not knowing. You just let yourself not know. When you're up against the sense of I, and yet you don't really know if I am the body, there's nothing but that space. There's nothing but space. And you can just stay present to space, to a sense of there being nothing behind your eyes, nothing behind your thoughts, nothing behind your feelings. And then, as I'm speaking about it now, nothing behind the conviction, I am the body. What a strange thing to discover, that such a basic belief, that there's actually nothing to it. It's just a thought. I used to always use the example of when someone, that saying, he was a legend in his own mind. That's the flavor of when something is just a thought. When someone thinks something, but there's no actual reality to it. There's no concrete reality actually backing it up. And so when you come to that space, that sense of nothing behind your eyes, nothing behind your thoughts, nothing behind the sense, I am the body, and you just stay there, it can be both a huge relief if you're able to kind of fall into that not knowing, and you find out it's actually a huge relief not to be a body anymore, to not hold that kind of limiting, incorrect assumption. And so instead of turning back to thinness when you don't find anything, instead of turning back to another idea about who am I, you just stay there in the no-thingness, the nothingness, and get curious about it. No-thing, nothing, what's that like? So this is the surprising kind of purpose or goal of self-inquiry, is not to come up with a new and more accurate or better story about who you are, but rather to get in touch with this not knowing. And if you keep looking and finding nothing, what you discover is even more space. Staying with the self-inquiry question to this depth, staying with the who am I or what am I, opens up space. Nothingness, if you stop and think about it, if there's truly nothing, it's very spacious. There's a lot of room in it. There's no boundaries. There's nothing limiting it. When you stay in that nothingness you discover that there's a, you actually then also discover that there's a lot of stuff in that space. Stuff that is real in a way that the stuff in the world has never been real. What moves in that space are true qualities of being, such as love, compassion, insight, and strength. So this is a specific example of what I spoke about the last time I talked about self-inquiry, which is that when you do this kind of inquiry, you often come up against a space, a nothing, an empty spot. And our mind's tendency is to see that as something missing or lacking, like there's you're doing it wrong because you're not finding anything, you're not having an experience of your true self, so you must be inquiring in the wrong way or in the wrong direction. But that actually, if you can just stay, again, wholeheartedly with everything you've got in the experience of not knowing, in the experience of space itself, in the experience of nothing, it's in that space that something more real, more profound can be, it's hard to say exactly what it is. It's like you uncover it, but actually as you uncover it, you often have the sense that it was always here. There's just a quality to it. When you experience true peace or true love or true joy, that it's both remarkable and also remarkably familiar. There's just this sense that, oh yeah, that's always here. And every time you turn towards beingness, towards the empty space of your beingness, it's possible that a different quality shows up. Being has an infinite number of qualities which show up fresh and different in every moment. These qualities can seem to exist in another dimension, as they have a depth and solidity about them that is more real than physical objects. This is hard to, you know, unless you, you know, if you've had, even just in your ordinary daily life, if you had moments of deep peace or deep joy, or felt a tremendous open-hearted love, even like a divine love for everything, you may have a sense of what I'm speaking about here, that those experiences are more real than physical objects. They have more impact on your being. They have more substantiality. And so, surprisingly, this, I'm calling it stuff, but it's really hard to define because it's not stuff in the usual physical sense, but this subtle stuff that appears in the nothingness when we do inquiry can turn out to be more real than all the stuff in your whole life, including your body, including you. Here's another practical tip. I just say that it's possible to do this inquiry alone by asking yourself the questions, or in a dyad, where one person asks a question and another person answers. Then the first person asks this question again, and so on. And then after a while, you can switch roles. This way of doing inquiry with two people is especially powerful, as it keeps you focused on the process and doesn't allow your mind to wander. And you know, the mind is great at wandering, so you may sit down to do inquiry, and then after a while you find you're actually thinking about planning your vacation or something like that. But if there's a person there, and after a few minutes they say, "Who are you?" And you have to answer, it keeps you wonderfully focused. Now there's one other little trick here. I may have mentioned this before, but if you are doing inquiry alone, and it is appropriate to do so, meaning if it's appropriate in the context that there's other people around that might not be appropriate, you might not want to do this on a crowded city bus, for instance. But if it's appropriate to do so, it can help to speak the questions and answers out loud. So you just sit there and you say out loud, "Who am I? I am a man. And if you are more than that, who are you? I am awareness. And if you are more than that, who are you?" And so forth. And so when you do the inquiry out loud, and by the way, this is true of any kind of spiritual exploration, it's there's something about it. And by the way, it works also to do it in a kind of journaling, in the form of writing it on a piece of paper. So you literally write out the question, who are you? And then you write out an answer. And then you follow up with a question, and then you write out an answer. But anytime you do it out loud, or you do it on paper, this is my little pet theory, and my sense is that the words go out your mouth or out your hand onto the paper, and then they go back in both ears. They go back in both of your eyes. And so it brings into play both hemispheres of your brain. So this is a unique way. I said a moment ago, I said, you know, it helps to do the inquiry wholeheartedly. Well, this is in a sense saying you can also do the inquiry with your whole brain. And on a very practical level, one way to bring your whole brain into the process is to do it out loud or to do it on paper. It kind of makes new connections. It's similar to the experience probably everyone has had, that when you're talking about something, you often have new insights into it. I think that might be a big part of the value of almost all kinds of therapy and talking therapy, is that our own words go out our mouth and go back in both our ears, and we make new connections. We have new insights, new understandings as a result. So doing the inquiry in this way is really a powerful kind of boost to the process. Again, bringing your whole brain into the process. And then the last practical pointer I gave, is the most important pointer of all. There are no wrong answers or wrong experiences when doing inquiry. We are not actually in control of what arises when we do inquiry. But there is an infinite intelligence unfolding everything in life. And it knows exactly what experience, insight, or understanding is needed in this and every moment. When you practice this formal kind of inquiry, or any time that you are simply curious about life and awareness and existence, wherever that process takes you in the moment is exactly where you need to be. Inquiry will sometimes lead you to dive deeply into the ultimate mysteries, and then the very next moment uncover an intensely contracted piece of your conditioning. So even when it seems like the inquiry takes you out of the deeper experiences, that's actually this divine intelligence working properly. Anytime it triggers a fear or resistance or overwhelming memory, or brings up some old piece of conditioning or a painful memory, that's all, as they say, grist for the mill. It's all actually a perfect result, a perfect example of the inquiry working. And so you don't need to kind of evaluate your process as you go. You can just be curious, be open, give it all you've got, and ask the questions. What an opportunity it is to see the truth of your experience. Who knows what new and unexpected doorway into essence, and what new undiscovered dimensions of being are hiding, say, in the place where our deepest wounding is stored. This is another example of that. I said, you know, you can find surprising richness in a place inside you that feels empty or lacking. The same thing is true of the contracted and painful places in our body, in our being, that if you stick with them, they often turn out to be great reservoirs of true nature. And it's almost like the flow of life is backed up in that part of your being. And so when you finally stop resisting it, stop moving away, and inquire into it, actually give it attention, it opens up, it can open up a very rich, full kind of flow of being. I say that the journey of inquiry is the ultimate roller coaster ride, which includes the highest highs and the lowest lows. it is all worthy of our fullest curiosity and of our fullest devotion and love. Now, I think, and this is, some of this is kind of repetitive with what I've talked about before, but hey, you know, it doesn't, never hurts to hear this stuff a few times. And for some of you, it might be the first time. So I have a list here of questions to use in self-inquiry. And the first ones are the ones I've already spoken a lot about, which is, who are you or what are you? And then you follow that up with whatever answer comes, you follow up with, if you are more than that, then who or what are you? It's a wonderful way to welcome and affirm the answer that has come without limiting yourself to that answer, to go beyond it, by saying, if you are more than that, who or what are you? You can also focus the question, say, who or what are you right now? In this moment, and then, if you are more than that, who or what are you? So you, without it being too conceptual, too abstract, you say, who are you right now, right this very moment? But whatever answer comes, you know, there might be a strong sense in that moment, I am the body, or I am this feeling of sadness, or I am this confusion, or whatever it is. But then you follow up with, after being very specific, you follow up with, if you are more than that, who or what are you? And then another wonderful kind of, it's almost like a follow-up question, is when you notice, when something does kind of come up in your experience, like, you know, it's like your attention wanders a little bit, and so you're looking out the window at the tree, or you're noticing, and you know, that your foot is itching, or something like that, or a thought comes into your mind. And so you can bring it back to a form of inquiry by asking, who or what is experiencing this thought, feeling, sensation, spaciousness, whatever it is? Who or what is seeing the tree outside the window? Who or what is feeling the itching in my foot? And so once you bring it back, who or what is seeing, who or what is hearing, who or what is noticing the sensation or the thought. And then it's kind of a obvious thing that the answer is me. I am seeing the tree. I'm seeing the tree outside the window. I'm feeling my itchy foot. I'm having a thought about something, something unrelated to my inquiry. And so you're back to that felt sense of I. If I am seeing the tree outside the window, then who or what is this I? Who or what is the I that sees? Now, sometimes just to help bring you into the experience, it can help to focus attention on your experience. So you can ask, what am I aware of right now? I'm aware of the sounds. I'm aware of Nirmala's voice. I'm aware of, a sensation in my shoulders. And then once again, you know, then that I, who or what is that I that is aware of Nirmala's voice? And you can check right now, who or what is the I that's hearing this voice? Is there an I that is hearing this voice? Is there really something called I? Now the next set of questions, I might even just jump into it because there's another section in the book, but all of this is both on my website and also in the book, everything is included. Another, a whole other way of playing with this I thought, playing with this experience of I through words, through language. And so I'm going to jump to that section. The section is entitled, Awareness is Me. Everything is part of the whole truth. Every thought, expression, or experience contains some truth. However, a particular thought, expression, or experience can contain more or less truth than another thought, expression, or experience. It is your heart, your sense of yourself. This is interesting. It's your sense of yourself, which is that feeling of I, that sense of I, that measures how true things are. It's a good motivation to pay attention to your sense of self, to your sense of I, when you start to discover that it's actually the accurate measure of how true things are. Very simply, a larger truth opens or softens or expands your heart or your sense of self. And then in contrast, if you experience a smaller truth, then the sense of yourself that that thought or feeling or experience gives you will be smaller or more contracted. For example, if right now you think, I'm separate from everyone and everything, notice how that affects your sense of self. And then compare the felt sense. This is again getting down to that more visceral quality of me. Notice what happens to the visceral sense of me when you think, I'm connected to everyone and everything. So the first one was, I'm separate from everyone and everything. I'm all alone here. And the second one is, I'm connected to everyone and everything. You could even add, I'm never alone. I'm never alone. Oh, I see someone typed in a question. Great. Someone said, don't the thoughts stop the self-inquiry? Well, here's the thing, it's true that thoughts focus or shape our awareness. They don't actually stop the flow of awareness. They don't actually, so in a sense, they don't stop the inquiry. But they do shape it. And again, a small, not very true thought, like I am separate from everyone and everything, or just the idea that, oh, I'm alone, I'm always going to be alone, something like that. Obviously, that profoundly shapes your awareness, and specifically shapes your awareness by contracting it. Contracting it onto a very small, superficial part of the truth. So you could say that they stop the self-inquiry, especially a thought like that. But the antidote isn't to try to stop thoughts. Because usually all you end up doing then is thinking about not thinking. And thinking, oh, it'd be better if I could just stop thinking for a moment. But the antidote is to, if thoughts really are, in a sense, interfering with your sense of I or contracting your sense of I, the antidote is to really feel that contraction, to really inquire into the thoughts. And not just into the content of your thoughts, but into this felt sense that I'm speaking about here. And you can even go further and hold the thought, I'm one with everyone and everything. I'm one with everyone and everything. And just feel that. Feel it on. If it's harder to think, to think the thought, I'm one with everything, everyone and everything, if it doesn't really kind of, if it's not familiar to really take on that experience, then you can approach it almost like just like you're experimenting, just trying it on, just like you would try on a sweater or a costume or a dress or a pair of pants, just to see how it fits. Are they tight? Are they loose? And so you don't have to like believe it or adopt it or make it your truth from now on, but just try it on for size and see how true it is. One day, I noticed that it felt truer to say, awareness is me, than to say, I am aware. It's not that it's untrue to say, I am aware, but it simply opened my sense of self. Again, this is this kind of visceral measure of how true something is. And I just discovered that it opened my sense of self more to say, awareness is me. And Cheryl also wrote, when I am more thoughtless, the awareness experience seems real versus thinking about the feelings. Yeah, it's, and this is what I, this is actually what I'm pointing to, is that you are more real and the experience is more real. Everything becomes more real when your awareness is being shaped in a more open, spacious way. And so, yeah, a narrow thought will give you, you know, it's like the difference between drinking out of a gushing hose, garden hose, versus trying to get your thirst quenched when you're drinking through a tiny little cocktail straw. You know, there's still water when you're busy thinking about something. There still are thoughts that have some significance, but there, it's never enough. It never gives you that fuller, expanded sense of self. So absolutely, you can trust when things seem more real, but I guess what I'm inviting here is to also trust when things seem less real. Because that, you know, it's kind of like the kids' game where you say you're getting warmer or you're getting colder. You need both. You need someone to tell you when you're getting colder. And so this inner guidance, this inner sense of how true things are, both tells us when something's truer and also tells us when something's less true. So anyways, I was saying that one day I was playing with it and I just found that it felt truer. It somehow, it fit. It fit more. You know, like I said, the sweater that fits versus the sweater that's too tight. Say, awareness is me. And so again, yeah, Cheryl writes, are you describing contrast? And absolutely. This is how we orient. This is how we experience the world of form and experience, is through contrast. And one form of the contrast is the contrast between something that opens and expands our experience of self and our awareness, and something else that has the opposite effect. And they're both, there's nothing wrong with either one. It's just, if you discriminate that difference, it helps you orient, helps you know something's really true or something's not very true. So in this day when I was experimenting, and it's clearly true, I am aware, but it simply opened my sense of self more to say, awareness is me. And what a difference that made to switch the subject and object in a sentence with the verb, to be in it, which implies an equivalence of that one thing is the other. Saying awareness is me seemed to emphasize awareness over me, which feels truer. My heart softens and expands more with that statement than with I am aware. It feels truer to notice how awareness is moving in this body than to have a sense that this body is somehow doing this thing called awareness. So by emphasizing the awareness, it felt truer. And so, you know, you don't have to take my word for it. You can just try these out. I'm going to read some statements, and you can take a moment to hold each of the following thoughts in your mind. And just notice any difference in how large, open, expanded, or relatively smaller, tighter, more contracted the sense of yourself becomes as you hold each thought. So again, it's really discriminating that contrast, discriminating the differences. I am aware versus awareness is me. So try those on. I am aware. Awareness is me. And then you can also turn the object of the sentence into a verb. So you can compare I am aware to I am awareing. So it's a funny verb, I am awareing, but I'm making up a verb there. But is it truer to say I am aware or to say I am this activity called awareness, I am awareing? And then when you turn it around, you can compare awareness is me versus awareness is me-ing. Awareness is doing this activity called me. I spoke some, when I was talking more specifically about inquiry, I said, that the I thought is actually the source of all our sense of separation. It is a thought that therefore does limit our sense of ourself. And it's an interesting thing to think that maybe awareness is thinking your thoughts. Awareness is me. Awareness is identifying. You're not doing it. It's awareness that's doing it. And so when you state that, when you put that into words, it can loosen up, shake up, stir up our usual sense of self, hopefully in a helpful way. And then you can replace the word I. It, again, especially for you, there's no right or wrong here. If for you it feels truer to say awareness is me, then you can replace the word I in a whole number of sentences or thoughts with the word awareness. So take a moment to notice which version of this sentence feels truer in your heart or sense of being. I am sitting here versus awareness is sitting here. I am sitting here, or awareness is sitting here. I hear Nirmala's voice versus awareness hears Nirmala's voice. And then you can even stretch that one a little more and say, awareness is Nirmala's voice. Or awareness is speaking. And then I am my body. This is again, that deep unconscious belief. I have a body, I am a body, either one of those. Versus awareness is my body. Or awareness has this body. Just try that on. Awareness has a body. Awareness has this body. It's not me that has this body. Awareness has this body. Awareness has always had this body. It's awareness that's aware of the body. So it's probably truer, potentially truer, again, trust your own visceral reaction, to say awareness has this body. And the last one, I like ice cream versus awareness likes ice cream. It's funny how that changes the... Imagine if you walked around all day saying, awareness likes ice cream. Awareness like wants to go for a walk. Awareness is laughing right now. It takes that sense of that contracted sense of I out of it. It allows that same experience to unfold, but of liking ice cream or even having ice cream. Awareness is having ice cream. I should be careful. I've always been accused of using too many food metaphors in my satsangs, and I remember once years ago some folks told me after satsang that after my satsangs they always somehow had this uncontrollable urge to go out and have ice cream. So, I'm sorry if I'm implanting any what do you call it, subliminal messages about ice cream by saying awareness likes ice cream. But it's, in my experience, awareness really likes ice cream. So this is just playing, right? There's actually no wrong way to speak or think. And it might still make sense to say, I like ice cream, especially in normal conversation. And fortunately, every sentence or thought contains some truth. Someone says, here, awareness likes pizza. So again, every sentence, every thought contains some truth. Even if some sentences or thoughts are very small expressions of truth. And so they will naturally result in a very contracted or small sense of self. There is no right size for the sense of self, since the sense of self you're experiencing right now is always correctly showing you how true your thoughts or experiences are in this and every moment. So again, it's an invitation to trust when your sense of self expands or softens or opens, and also trust when your sense of self contracts. That's letting you know that that particular thought or feeling is like a sweater that's too tight. It's small. It may be, there's nothing wrong with it. It may even be useful in that moment to contract your awareness in that way. Like if you're doing your taxes or balancing your checkbook, it might not be a problem to have a kind of narrow focused awareness that believes that the numbers on the page are real. But if you notice the contraction, then you can also recognize that the truth is not, that the truth that you're experiencing in that moment is not very big. So Our Lady says, awareness opens me up. Yeah, pure awareness, it has no boundaries. Pure awareness is limitless, and it's only when it's being shaped by thought or experience or form that it is, that it has, again, just relatively in contrast, has a sense of contraction to it. But again, I'm inviting you to trust that sense of contraction, and of course to really trust when awareness or your sense of self expands, because that is also an accurate response. That is also showing you that something you're experiencing in that moment is truer and may even be a earth-shattering, profound truth beyond anything you had ever experienced before. In a moment of awakening or realization, the sense of self can expand exponentially, can expand in a way that, you know, leaves even calling it a sense of self or calling it a me or referring to it as I no longer makes any sense at all, because it's so big. And so when you can't call your sense of self me anymore, that means you're experiencing something profoundly true. Now, how big an experience you're having is always changing. It's always shifting. It's not up to you. You're not doing it, really. Life is just unfolding. And so even right after a moment of awakening, a moment of profound realization, there's no predicting what the next moment will be like, what the next experience will be like. And so if something else pops into awareness that's not very true, a fear or a doubt or a judgment or an attachment, you know, even a judgment, a positive judgment of, oh, cool, I'm having an awakening experience, actually contracts it a little bit. I used to often use the example that when you're with a group of friends and you're all having a great time and laughing and joking, and then someone actually points it out, like conceptualizes it and comments on it and says, oh, aren't we having a great time? Isn't this just really fun? And all of a sudden it's like somehow strangely that judgment, that statement, can actually kind of contract things, make you some suddenly a little bit self-conscious about the whole thing and not just purely enjoying that flow with your friends. So it's a very subtle thing. It can be a very slight contraction, very slight expansion, or it can be a very profound contraction or a very profound expansion. Again, the invitation is to adjust, to trust it, to trust every moment's sense of me. So that all being said, it kind of points to a whole nother, almost like a whole nother dimension to the process of inquiry that, you know, the last kind of practical pointer I gave was that there are no wrong answers to the inquiry process. And so if you ask the question and it gives you, and the answer that arises, you know, in that moment gives you a very contracted sense of self. It just, your experience in that moment is, I am afraid, or I am, you know, just, you know, it's like you sat down to do inquiry, but the truth is you're really upset. You're really worried about something and you just can't help yourself, you know. And so when you try to do self-inquiry, you find this sense of self that's very contracted. And that's great. That's a wonderful thing if you can notice it, if you can be curious about that contracted sense of self. I often like to say that even a single drop of water is wet. And so even a contracted sense of self, even a very contracted sense of self, like that, you know, people talk about the inner child, which is really just a very contracted sense of self that is maybe the size of a small child. And then I often have experienced certain kind of fearful or judgmental thoughts, self-judgmental thoughts, you know, thoughts of low self-worth and that kind of thing. I feel even smaller than a child, smaller than a tiny bug. And that's the right way for that thought to feel. You want a small sweater to feel small. You want a loose and comfortable sweater to feel loose and comfortable. And so this inquiry, it uncovers not just, as you get more familiar with it, it not only uncovers like how true an experience is that you're having, how true your sense of self is in that moment, how true a statement like I am a jerk or I am genius or I am wonderful or I am horrible, you know, just how true those are. If you start to discover that you can trust that sense of expansion or contraction with those kind of relative thoughts and also with the moments where there is no thought. If there is no thought shaping awareness, then your sense of self, your awareness, can expand freely. Which, by the way, is not something you do. That expansion of awareness is just what happens when there's nothing shaping it. So when your mind falls silent, your sense of self can expand profoundly. But as you experience this, as you direct some of your attention through inquiry to the sense of I, to the felt sense of I, and ultimately, yes, of course, ultimately to the pure sense of I, without definition, without, which often, like I said, you can go through layers where it feels like there's no I, where there's no self, and then there's a deeper, truer sense of self, and then even that turns out to be another layer of, you could call illusion, another layer of form, kind of shaping that pure awareness that has no shape, has no form. And as you move in and out of those extremely profound levels of truth, and right back down into awareness likes ice cream, or I am a jerk, or I was a jerk. Anything that brings it back down. And yet, if you're asking about, if you're curious about, if you're inquiring into the felt sense of I, if you take the time to actually notice it, even when it's contracted, then it may also start to kind of catch the flavor of its heart. It's not something you can actually conceptualize or ultimately define, but you can start to catch the flavor of this thing we're calling awareness, or I, or self, or being. Because it's here right now. It's here if you're feeling contracted. It's here if you're feeling expanded. Like I said earlier, even a single drop of water is wet. And so everything that really matters about your true nature is present even in a contracted sense of self. In fact, the contraction itself is a functioning of your true nature. It is, as I'm saying, it is the aspect of our true nature that discriminates how true things are. So the contraction itself is a sign that your true nature is present and functioning. And a quality of our true nature is it's discriminating. It can distinguish contrast and difference. It doesn't have to do anything extra to do that. It just automatically does it. Anytime you're aware of something, you're aware of the differences inherent in that experience. And so even the contraction is a sign of your true nature functioning perfectly. Kind of, if you really get that, it kind of turns this whole process of spiritual seeking, it kind of turns it inside out. Because what is there to seek if this pure true nature, awareness, being is here right now all the time? You can become more curious about it. You can start to trust its capacity to discriminate how true things are. You can notice how true are feelings, how true are your thoughts, how true are your desires, how true are your deeply felt senses of connection and oneness, how true is an experience of overwhelming joy. But you don't have to seek anything. The experiencing itself is already here. The awareness, the answer to that question, who am I, that, you know, at best we come up with words like awareness that point to these very subtle and ever-present qualities that are actually really difficult to define in words. What is awareness? You know, which is why the, you know, purely conceptual answers to the question, who am I, what am I, are not, you know, they don't usually, if it's purely conceptual, it doesn't expand your sense of self. It doesn't give you a direct, stronger experience of that mystery called awareness. And yet, the mystery of awareness is present. If you are feeling contracted, then something is aware of contraction. If you are experiencing awareness liking ice cream, then there's something aware of either the liking, if there's no ice cream in the picture, or just the liking, or there's something that's aware of the ice cream while you're eating it. Even if your attention, your sense of self is totally contracted, and you know, especially when you get down to the last bite and it's like, oh, that's the last bite, oh, what now? And yet there's awareness, it's the last bite. Have you ever not been aware when you got to the bottom of the bowl and there was no more ice cream? No, awareness does not wait outside while you get all contracted and obsessed with ice cream. Awareness jumps right in, has this full-blown experience of ice cream and of the experience of the ending of ice cream. The experience when you can't, you know, even if you scrape the bowl with the spoon, you can't really get anything on the spoon anymore. Awareness is right there. It doesn't hold back. I used to joke that awareness is a total slut for experience. It jumps into bed with every experience that appears. Everything from a painful experience to the most expanded experience of awakening. And that's the surprising kind of, it's almost like a side effect, a side benefit of this practice of inquiry. That instead of necessarily, I mean, it does bring you experiences of expansion, which again, is kind of not something you really do. It's just by tracking your sense of self, tracking the I thought, tracking your experience of self, you experience these fluctuations. And you can even discover what is beyond the sense of self. What is self beyond any sense of self? And that's profoundly liberating profoundly expansive and often a huge sense, there's a huge sense of relief in that. And yet, there's an even bigger freedom when it doesn't matter anymore. When you've learned to trust the moments of expansion, the moments of contraction, and everything in between. And by the way, sometimes it's a moment of neither expansion nor contraction, which just means that whatever you're experiencing is about as true as whatever you were just experiencing. So like if you're trying to decide whether to have soup or salad, and you can't notice any difference in expansion or contraction, then it's because there's no difference. They're both equally true in that moment. That's a very simplistic example, but sometimes you move from peace to joy, and there's no difference in how true peace is compared to how true joy is. It's just a different flavor of that same self, of that same presence that has this quality we call awareness. So the surprising kind of result of self-inquiry is not where it takes you, but how it eventually reveals that where you've always been is in the self. That is what has always been experiencing everything, including all of your spiritual practices and in any time you spent doing formal self-inquiry. The point of the self-inquiry wasn't to take you somewhere that you aren't already, but instead to reveal what is always present in all of its mysterious richness and variety and capacity for expansion and contraction. What a funny place to end up after all that seeking and searching and journeying through all different dimensions and realities to come home to the place you never left, the place you've always been, right here as yourself, with or without definition, with or without boundaries, with or without. Those all come and go. The definitions, the flavors, the boundaries, the qualities, they all come and go. But if it's what you are, if we really are inquiring into who am I, then it's kind of by definition, it has to be something that's here. And it has to be something that's always been here. It can't be something out there. You can have a different experience of it, but you can't lose it. I challenge you to stop being, stop being, to just stop being, to stop being yourself, stop being aware. Try and turn it off. Try and not be aware for a minute, and then you may have a sense of how it's always here, because you can't turn it off. All right. You can't turn off awareness, but awareness can move on to the next program on the schedule, which it's time for, I think, oh, there's Regina. Yeah, I think it's time for Regina. So you don't have to turn off your awareness. You can just redirect it now to Regina. And thanks again, and I'll see you all next week. Or actually, I won't be available next week, so I'm going to set something up with Cheryl to play in a recording. I think I might even just play the recording of one of the talks I gave over a year ago. So I will see you live and in person in 2 weeks. Take good care. Bye for now. Mm-hmm.